Today, we're going to open with Operation Fuel, a nonprofit partnering with local government and community-based organizations at more than 100 sites throughout Connecticut to ensure that families and individuals in need have access to year-round energy assistance. Did you know that more than 400,000 Connecticut households can't afford their energy bills? And this winter, many Connecticut families and individuals are struggling to survive in dark, frigid homes. So we're going to tell you how to help and invite you to experience what those families might be feeling at the second annual Ice House event coming up January 24th and 25th in Hartford. Then we're going to touch base with AARP Connecticut, which recently selected 7 awardees for its second Livable Communities Grant Program, dedicated to funding quick action projects across Connecticut communities that'll help make immediate improvements or jumpstart long-term progress, supporting residents with projects aiming to help neighborhoods, towns, and cities become great places for people of all ages. Is your communities on the list? Stay tuned to find out. Then we're going to close visiting with our neighbors right here in Milford. Since 1942, Boys and Girls Village has evolved into an agency serving more than 800 clients across 50 communities, treating children and families in at-risk situations and assisting them in returning to healthy and developmental pathways. In our final segment, we're going to meet and chat with Dr. Kimberly Shaughnessy, President and CEO, and hear about the new Boys and Girls Village Life Skills and Vocational Training Center and a brand new partnership with Housatonic and Gateway Community Colleges. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Boquette, right after this reminder. How can you get your kids or school community more interested in planting seeds, growing leaders, and cultivating community? On February 1st, New Haven's own Common Ground Farm and Schoolyards program is hosting its next Winter Farm and Garden Conference, a day or half day of learning perfect for the school educator, backyard gardener, small-scale farmer, curious food explorer, or food justice activist. The conference even features a kids' track for children ages 5 through 12. Join them for half or full days of workshops on gardening, cooking, herbal remedies, and more. This isn't a drop-off program, by the way. All children have to be accompanied by an adult who is on site and attending the conference. If you'd like to learn more and get registered, hit the event tab at commongroundct.org. Right about this time every year, we check in with our long and dear friends at Operation Fuel. That agency partners with local government and community-based organizations at more than 100 sites throughout Connecticut to ensure that families and individuals in need have access to year-round energy assistance. That's right. It's not just in the winter, but you often hear Operation Fuel as a guest on our program in the summer, too, because they also help with energy assistance when folks in need to stay cool in the summertime. But right now, in addition to helping folks apply for energy assistance program, the partner agencies of Operation Fuel can also perhaps connect individuals in need with other programs that provide assistance for food, clothing, health services, child care, and more. This is one of the most exciting things about it, because Operation Fuel is so easy to support and they do so much good. And speaking of doing good, we've got a brand new do-gooder with Operation Fuel on the show right now. We're pleased to meet Dana Varchelos-Allen. She has been the Director of Development and Marketing with Operation Fuel for about a year now. Dana, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much, John. We're really glad to have the opportunity and your support to be able to talk about the mission that we do that's really made possible by the people who listen to your show, who make those donations and show up to help our neighbors.
That's right. And we've often talked with various staffers and directors of Operation Fuel about how if every eligible consumer of electric or gas utilities in Connecticut just check that box to give a dollar out of every utility payment and direct it to Operation Fuel, essentially, you know, you guys would virtually be out of business. I mean, there would be you'd be a pass through, but you'd be able to really, really put a lot of effort toward defeating folks who are currently in crisis or in need because they can't afford their winter energy. And the program for this winter has been in effect for about a month. But before we talk about that and how folks can still get involved if they need help, and especially how folks can give help, let's talk about you for a few minutes. We chatted before we went on the air. You've went from Texas to California, now over here to Connecticut. What was it that attracted you to Connecticut and eventually to come to Operation Fuel?
You know, it turns out I am a winter person. Growing up in Texas and California, you wouldn't expect that. We visited here, fell in love with New England, loved the winters. But obviously, the winters are a big change here, and it's bitter cold. I have always worked in the nonprofit industry. I worked for the American Red Cross, worked for Girl Scouts, and so mission-driven organizations are very important to me. And so when the opportunity came to join Operation Fuel, obviously, that mission is so critical here. You know, last night, the wind chill was, you know, down in the teens, and it's just bitter, and it's terrible to think about people who are in the dark, people who are in the cold, and people who don't have electricity to do basic things like cook food or keep their food stored properly or their baby bottles stored at proper temperatures in the summertime. And so it was a very compelling mission that I wanted to jump in and help out with, and I'm so glad I did. I do think Connecticut has one of the best safety nets of social services that I've seen anywhere I've lived, and Operation Fuel is a huge part of that.
Yeah. Were you a scout yourself as a
young
person? I
did, yeah. I grew up in Girl Scouting. I got my Gold Award, which is the equivalency of an Eagle Scout Award, and always grew up, since I was 6 years old, wanting to make the world a better place, and I think that that's one of the reasons I'm so drawn to being a part of Operation Fuel, because nothing makes the world better than providing your neighbors with warmth and with light.
Yeah, I had a feeling you were a former scout. So,
yeah.
So on this program over the past few weeks, we've been talking a lot about homelessness and folks who are literally out in the cold without shelter. And that represents a really scary number of people in the state of Connecticut, but it pales in comparison to the amount of people who have a roof over their head and are blessed to that extent, but who have to like make these hard decisions between, you know, affording something for maybe their kids that they have to have for school, or heaven forbid, prescription medication, food, you know, juggling whether or not to pay one bill or the other. And that's really where Operation Fuel makes a difference. So many of these families that come to your partners across the state of Connecticut for assistance are parents, single parents, families who are challenged, and the elderly, right?
Absolutely. It's the vulnerable population that has the most critical needs. So people, like you mentioned, seniors who are on a limited budget, who are having to make choices. You know, we've paid mortgage, we've paid rent, we have medicine, you know, but we only have so many funds. What do we cut? And you'd be surprised at the number of people who make it through a winter every year by having, you know, no heat. It is a really sad situation, and our elders don't deserve to have to do that, which is why we're just so thrilled to have so many people who step up and give to Operation Fuel through all those different ways that you talked about. And I know we'll talk about the Add a Dollar program, but, you know, this summer we worked with, you know, we talk about elderly, we talk about families with children, we talk about working class families, but one of the things that we do that is kind of a quieter need is we work with families who fall just above that poverty line, who aren't necessarily eligible for other types of assistance. And it might be families with two parents in the home, both working jobs, who just get behind on energy costs. And energy costs are high here in Connecticut and high in, you know, many other states. And it's a struggle. And when you add into the situation things like medical bills that might happen, you know, goodness forbid that someone gets sick, all those kind of things, you know, choices have to be made. And
it was
interesting that you mentioned homelessness, because that's one of the things that Operation Fuel does that I think is one of the greatest things. There's a program called the Homeless Intervention and Prevention Program. And what it does is it helps people who are either facing having to be out of their home or already out of the home and in a shelter get back into a place because we're able to help people pay off past electric bills. Mm-hmm. Because the Department of Children and Family Services considers utilities, not having utilities in your home, a form of neglect. And so children can be taken away, families can end up in shelters. And it's not as simple as, you know, gosh, I'm going to get out of the shelter, I'm going to find a new place to go back into. If you owe electricity bills or if you owe natural gas bills or oil bills, you know, that's those arrearages are hanging over your head. And so it's one of the things this homeless prevention program helps with as well.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention and tie into is actually something you talked about a few minutes ago, and that is your surprise and respect for Connecticut's myriad safety nets for people. A lot of times when I mention Operation Fuel over the many years that we've had you guys on the show, people say, oh, well, Connecticut has laws and protections. They don't let utilities turn people's power or electricity off, gas or heat in the wintertime. But I mean, that last ditch preventative effort, it really isn't the way these folks should be handled, right?
Right, absolutely. And, you know, that sort of calls to mind, the qualifications are there, and it's a fantastic thing that for people under a certain economic level, that yes, there's that, and thankfully there's the program to keep electricity from being cut off. But for people who fall above that financial line, people who may be making just enough money to not qualify for that, those are some of the people who are the, you know, I would call them, you know, silent recipients, people who are struggling, who there's a term called ALICE, which you're probably aware of, which is assets limited income, income constrained, and it's for people who are working, who own homes, who are, you know, conceivably doing fine, but bills are piling up and there's no extra. So if you have a job loss, if you have a medical issue, if you just have, I mean, for goodness sakes, think of, you know, if my, today I'm actually sitting at home waiting for a technician to come out and take a look at our heater, you know, and we hope that the furnace system is doing well, but if our furnace went out, that'd be a struggle for us.
Yeah, that one. That
regardless
one...
of the fact that you know, we work, you know, decent jobs and make a decent living, it'd be a big struggle to all of a sudden lose a heating system. And that doesn't take into consideration oil as well. So a lot of places get their homes heated by oil here, and that oil companies don't seem to have that same kind of moratorium in the winter that places like Eversource do, like Eversource for electricity. And so that's where we spend a lot of time in our winter helping people who need placement fuel assistance.
Yeah. Well, the 43rd Winter Energy Assistance Program started just a little over a month ago when its statewide network of fuel banks began accepting energy assistance applications. But here we are, you know, 34, 35 days into the program. Folks can still apply by calling 211 InfoLine or their fuel bank in their community, right?
Absolutely. So 211 is just a fantastic resource for us. They work directly with our Operation Fuel Banks. We've got 108 of them located across the state. So if a person needs assistance, if you're facing utility shutoff, if you've had a hot water heater that's broken, that you're having issues trying to replace and can't afford that, if you can't afford fuel bills, natural gas bills, or if you're having issues with furnaces, nobody deserves to be cold. And so we encourage everybody to reach out to 211. They'll connect you with an Operation Fuel fuel bank, and then we will work to get people assistance. And we do all this, again, because we are so fortunate to have donors and corporations and agencies who really support this effort. Operation Fuel was founded, like you said, 43 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was with then Governor Ella Grasso and members of the faith community who reached out, and the program was called Warm Thy Neighbor very early on, or that was kind of the initiative that they did.
Right.
And, you know, that's still what we're doing today. We're still making sure that our neighbors are warm and that they're safe in their homes.
Well, we want to remind people they can go to operationfuel.org to learn about more of the what you folks are doing and how to connect through to perhaps apply for energy assistance. But also they can go to operationfuel.org to learn more about how to donate. Obviously, they can write a check or make a donation directly. No amount is too little. But the other, as we said earlier in the program, the other easy way to do it is just get your utility bill or connect with your utility company and authorize them to take and add a dollar to each utility bill that you pay that then goes directly to Operation Fuel. 100% of that donation goes right to the folks who need it most.
Right, absolutely. And add a dollar is really, truly the easiest way that you can give. It's very little work. You sort of like check the box and you get to forget about it. When I first moved here, I checked the box and I wasn't even aware of what Operation Fuel did. But I thought, gosh, you know, here we are in these harsh winters. Of course, I want to add a dollar, add $2, you know, kind of what you can afford to your monthly bill. And that's sort of a less painful way to give. Because, you know, you're not necessarily missing a dollar as much as you might if you can't afford to give larger chunks. And, you know, so like you said, every dollar makes a difference. We broke down the average cost of electricity in Connecticut per month, and it's about $127 per month per household. You break that down, that's about $4 a day to pay for one day of electricity. So, you know, if we have four people checking that box to do add a dollar, you know, you're taking care of 4 days of electricity for somebody. We've got great partners with the utilities like Eversource, United Illuminating, Connecticut Natural Gas, and now the Metropolitan District, Water District, who is also a partner, who also have add-a-dollar programs. And so you can go online to operationfuel.org, click on add-a-dollar at the top, find your company, and basically go ahead and go over and check that box, and it makes an enormous difference.
Yeah. The other thing we talked about is, folks who are inside their homes. They've got a roof over their head, but they can't afford to either pay for the energy that it takes to keep them warm, or they force themselves to take the thermostat down so low to conserve fuel that they're cold all the time. And a lot of folks probably can't relate to that. They turn the thermostat on, they walk in the house, or they dial up on their smartphone and tell the thermostat to warm up the house while they're on the way home. And nice warm envelope. But you're giving folks a real time, hands-on opportunity to understand what it's really like to be in a cold house. And I'm talking about a really, really cold house. Let's hear about the second annual Ice House event that's coming up on January 24th and 25th.
Sure. You know, it's energy affordability and the crises that happen from that is very serious. But what we've done is, this is the second year, where we're kind of having, making it a little more fun, if you will, because we're building a giant ice house out of 40,000 pounds of ice in downtown Hartford that's going to have chairs inside of it. There's going to be a brand new ice garage on it this year. So to raise awareness of what it feels like, because you're right, we do take it for granted when we walk in and we flip on the light switch and we've got lights to do our homework by, or, you know, to cook, you know, healthier food on a stove. Visitors will have the opportunity to come down to the old State House grounds on January 24th and 25th and come to our ice house and see what it's like to be inside there, take selfies. It looks amazing. But the other fun thing that we're doing new this year is we've added a thermal camera, so we'll be able to take body heat thermal imaging photos of your body heat up against the ice house. So that's kind of a new and fun way to see, you know, the contrast between here's the warmth in me and then here's, you know, this totally cold, barren sort of house. There's going to be mascots down there. We've got great giveaways that are happening. Lots of it's just going to be a really neat time, and it's a free event. So we encourage everybody to come down, take a look, and then if people want to make a donation, we will certainly be accepting donations on site. If you want to make a suggested contribution, like that $4 a day to cover a day of electricity would be perfect.
Fantastic. Well, we really appreciate all the time in helping us remember all the folks who are out in the cold this winter and how Operation Fuel is making a difference in their lives, and also reminding us about this homeless program, which is fantastic. Dana Barcelos Allen is Operation Fuel's Director of Development and Marketing. This organization partners with 100-plus community-based organizations throughout the state to ensure that families and individuals in need have access to year-round energy assistance. Come on out and feel the cold yourself. Get empathy and give to Operation Fuel at the second annual Ice House event Friday, January 24th.
Friday, yeah, Friday, January 24th and Saturday, January 25th.
Yeah, at the Old State House in Hartford. Dana, thanks so much. We'll see you there. Well, Over the past 8 or 10 years, we've been touching base pretty regularly with AARP Connecticut, and we've made the acquaintance of Anna Dorigazzi. She's Associate State Director for Advocacy and Outreach. She's been with us before to talk about how Connecticut and our communities here have gotten so involved in the National AARP Community Challenge and how so many communities in Connecticut here are becoming classified as AARP livable communities. And the work that's being done there is so fantastic that these communities or groups within them are applying for AARP Livable Communities grants. And this year, AARP Connecticut has selected 7 awardees for the second Livable Communities Grant Program, which is dedicated to fund quick action projects in Connecticut communities that'll help make immediate improvements or jumpstart long-term progress that'll support residents. The thing that I really like about these grants, Anna, and as we talked a little before we went on the air this morning, I've been involved in a community that has been very, very proactive with the AARP Livable Communities Initiative and the grant program application over the past couple of years. And they were one of the first livable communities in Connecticut, but now that there are many. And this grant program is so awesome because you tell them right up front, we're going to give you the money if you qualify and we pick you, but we want that project off the ground and done right away, which really kind of makes the process exciting, but it also makes, puts the deliverable in immediate reach for all the folks that are involved, right?
That's correct. Yeah. So first of all, thanks for having me. Sure. I'm really excited to talk about these grants and to talk about some of the good work that we think we're going to be seeing from these grantees out in their communities in the next few months. But yeah, you're absolutely right. These are meant to just be quick, up to $2,500 projects that we want the grantees to get the money in hand and turn right around and make a difference in their community. So these aren't major systemic changes or huge infrastructure projects. The goal of our AARP Connecticut Livable Communities Grant Program is to help communities undertake just small projects that we think are going to improve people's lives. Mm. There aren't a lot of small-scale funding opportunities out there. So for a town or a nonprofit that says, you know, we have this great space, but we want to make it more accessible, but, you know, how do I get my hands on $2,000 or $2,500? Mm. This is the grant program that does that and says, you know, do you want your space to be more accessible? Do you have an outdoor space that you want to be a better spot for your community? Do you want to bring people together in a new and exciting way? Just these real kind of low budget, quick action things are exactly what we're going for with this grant.
And these are accessible annually to nonprofit organizations and municipalities. They have to be 501c3 or 501c4 nonprofits or Connecticut government entities. And this is the second year of the grant program. But let's kind of ratchet the focus out to a more national or global level and talk about, to the extent that you can, about the Livable Communities Initiative as a movement, because I think a lot of people, when they hear AARP, even if they are of the age of qualifying for membership, and certainly a lot of younger folks, suddenly the volume goes down or the attention diverts because they think, oh, well, I'm not ready for that. I'm not part of that yet. But in fact, what AARP is doing here is universal to everyone in the community. And these grant programs typically are underwriting projects that are not exclusive for AARP members by any means, or even seniors, right?
Right. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind about what a livable community is. A livable community isn't just a place that's great to live when you're 80 or 90. A livable community is a place that's great for people of all ages.
I think it's important to take the interests of aging and older folks into consideration when we think about our communities. But that's, you know, our angle there, you know, one is because we're AARP and that's what we do.
Sure.
But also we hear so much about, you know, how do we get millennials to come to our state or to our city? How do we, you know, have these really hip spots for places to go? But I think the concept of a livable community is, you know, how do we look across the lifespan and think about ways to design social services, to design physical spaces that work for everybody? Mm. Because at the end of the day, you know, whether you're a mom pushing a stroller or, you know, a toddler just learning how to walk or a person in a wheelchair or an older person with some mobility issues, you're going to want a lot of the same things in your public spaces. You're going to want, you know, ramps, you're going to want curb cuts, you're going to want, you know, doors that are wide enough to get through.
Mm.
So a community that has taken these things into consideration and has designed spaces or services or activities that work for people across their lifespan is going to be a community where everybody feels welcome and everyone feels included and everybody can go about their business no matter what age they are.
Also, Anna, I think across the country over the past 10 to 20 years, the dynamic of communities and certainly neighborhoods and even households has changed. We're seeing a lot more grandparents that are parenting the parents' children or their children's children. We're seeing a lot more mixed households where the grandparents aren't relegated to an in-law apartment, but they're part of the actual family community within the household itself. So we're seeing a lot more of the embracing of a multi-generational situation in communities. And not just across Connecticut, but around the country.
Yeah, and I think you know, there are a lot of big demographic changes that we need to take into consideration when we're thinking about what communities look like now and what they should look like. So right now, Connecticut has about 30% or so of its population that's over the age of 50, which is more or less in line with national trends. But by 2035, the number of people over the age of 65 is expected to be greater than the number of people under 18. So this is a huge demographic shift. We haven't had that dynamic in the past in this country. So we need to take a look at, you know, what does that mean? What does that mean for the way we move around our communities? What does that look like for, you know, our housing stock? You mentioned, you know, we have more sort of multi-generational households. Well, what does that look like? You know, where are those households? I think we see a lot of housing stock, you know, kind of post-World War II, where everybody, you know, wanted to be in the suburb and have a big house and, you know, their own piece of land. And those trends are changing. People are saying, you know, I want to be closer to where I work. I don't want to spend 45 minutes each way in the car. I'd like to take a train. I'd like to, you know, maybe I want to live above a storefront. I want to be able to work and live and shop and play.
Yeah, being in a mixed
all in one community.
Sure, exactly. Yeah, just your commute to the grocery store or the neighborhood market is just kind of down the stairs and around the corner instead of jumping in the car and getting the bags and yada yada. So definitely true, and it's great to see once again how AARP is really kind of forward thinking in that respect. And it must be a really exciting time for people like you, Anna, because of this explosion of the demographic that could continue to flow into AARP membership. And by virtue of that, helping to make both AARP programs like the Livable Communities Initiatives and these communities grant programs more robust and comprehensive. We're going to take a quick break. We're with Anna Dorigasi. She's Associate State Director for Advocacy and Outreach for AARP Connecticut. Is your community one of the recipients of the second round of Connecticut Livable Communities grants? Well, stick with us until after the break, and we're going to review the grants that were just awarded here and find out if there's one happening in your community or your area. We'll be back with Anna Dorigasi from AARP Connecticut right after this break. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this. Have you heard one too many stories about youths in your community being lost to substance abuse and addiction? Then now is the time to start planning how you can empower youth about the importance of living a drug-free lifestyle. The Courage to Speak Foundation offers presentations for both youth and parents. Based in Norwalk, Ginger Katz, founder and CEO of the Courage to Speak Foundation, has presented across the country about the dangers of drugs. The Courage to Speak presentation combines Ms. Katz's personal story of losing her son to a drug overdose, with the latest research-based information on substance abuse and addiction to form a unique and powerful presentation that students and parents will remember for years to come. To request a Courage to Speak presentation and drug prevention education program at your school or community group, just visit CourageToSpeak.org. We're back with Anna Dorigazzi. She's Associate State Director for Advocacy and Outreach for AARP Connecticut. This year, AARP, as part of its second annual round of Livable Communities grants, has selected seven projects or awardees for this program. These are funding quick action projects across the state to help make immediate improvements to jumpstart long-term progress that'll support all residents, not just those who can qualify for AARP membership. So, Anna, let's run down the punch list here. First, I guess congratulations goes to the Community Renewal Team. Tell us a little bit about this project and the community that they are located in.
Sure. So Community Renewal Team is a nonprofit organization that serves several communities kind of in the greater Hartford area. Mm-hmm. And they have a subsidized assisted living community for low-income older folks in Hartford called The Retreat. And they proposed a program that we thought was really, really interesting from this livable communities angle, where they are going to be purchasing two iPad devices that their staff and their volunteers can use to interact, to help some of the residents at this assisted living facility either play interactive games, listen to music, or to visit with relatives or other loved ones using Skype. So what's so cool about this program is that it touches on kind of an aspect of livable communities that AARP thinks about a lot, which is how do we make sure that people still feel a sense of social inclusion as they age? So we hear a lot about, you know, as people age, they might experience loneliness, and this has very, very negative impacts sort of on their mental well-being, but also their health. There's all this new research out there saying, you know, if you're lonely, you're not going to live as long as folks who are better connected. You're not going to have as good health outcomes. So we're really excited about this program that's going to help connect older folks in this community in Hartford. With things to do to keep them active and mentally engaged, or to help them connect with the people they care about.
Cool. We do a lot of talking, especially lately, about urban gardening here on the award-winning For the People. So it's exciting to see that Fairgate Farm down in Stamford got a Livable Communities grant to put a ADA-compliant stone walkway at their Fairgate Farm urban farm. That is another one of the grant recipients. And they're also going to do some improvements, I guess, to some of the facilities at the farm, right?
Yeah. So one of the things that's great about this project is that you have a space that's already a good community space. You know, the farm has a publicly accessible urban garden. They have a farmer's market. But they said, you know what? Not everybody can get to these spaces. It's not working for everybody in the community. So let's make sure that, you know, if you're pushing a stroller, you're using a walker, you're using a wheelchair, let's allow everyone in the community to access these good spaces that we've already made. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's sort of an important cornerstone of this idea of a livable community. You know, is it accessible? Do you have features of the built environment that are keeping people from participating in activities or keeping people out of spaces?
Another cool.
So this is,
sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. This is one of those things where it's kind of a simple fix, but yeah. it opens a space to more members of the community,
oh, yeah.
And that's always a good thing.
It can create access to an entire demographic that would have either had difficulty and maybe been discouraged from going to the farm market or the urban garden, which is, I'm told, really important from urban gardeners themselves. They want to be able to go there, but they want it to be easy for them to be able to tend their urban garden. So that's really important. Hey, I see Simsbury is factoring their Livable Communities grant right into their 350th anniversary, and they're going to be utilizing their grant for both an intergenerational art program and scavenger hunt.
Yeah, I really love this project a lot. And I should mention that Simsbury is one of four communities in Connecticut that's part of our national AARP network of age-friendly communities. Mm. So Simsbury, Newtown, Greenwich, and Glastonbury are all communities that have said, you know what, we really want to commit to this idea of livability and of being age-friendly. So Simsbury, kind of as a town, has made that commitment. But then this intergenerational art program and scavenger hunt is being headed up by a new organization called For All Ages. And the idea is that they're bringing together older residents and Girl Scouts to come together to do kind of a craft activity. They're coming together, they're painting rocks, and then these rocks are going to be numbered and hidden throughout the town of Simsbury. Mm-hmm. So if you find a rock out in the community, you can turn it in. Some of the numbers on those rocks will win you a prize. But it's cool in two ways, because it's telling the community, you know, go out, engage with the space around you. Keep your eyes open when you're walking around town. See if you can find some of these rocks. But more importantly, it's bringing together older folks and younger folks in the community. And we know that there's so much benefit from bringing together people of different generations to get to know each other, to talk to each other, and to develop these relationships.
Yeah. Also, in Willimantic, way out in Willimantic, way beyond our airwaves, the Holy Family Home and Shelter is going to be upgrading bathrooms in their shelter to become fully accessible for women and children to access them, especially those who are using wheelchairs. And also out in Eastern Connecticut, the New London Maritime Society is planning to utilize their grant to fortify a little pocket park, right?
Yeah, yep. So we have these two projects, just a straight-up accessibility project at Holy Family Home and Shelter in Willimantic, making sure that homeless women and children of all ages can access the facilities they need to live comfortably in that home. And then, yeah, New London Maritime Society said, we have this courtyard space, but we think it could be a better space. We don't want this to be a space that gets overlooked. We want people in New London to say, hey, that's a cool place. I want to go there. I want to visit. I want to spend time in this little pocket park.
Over in Cromwell, they're using their AARP Livable Communities grant to purchase 30 assistive listening devices. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. So by purchasing these assisted listening devices, the idea is that the town said, you know, we have this great programming at the senior center. We do movie nights in the park. We have town concerts. We do town walking tours. They're great things that the town's doing. But if you're hard of hearing, it's really hard to participate in this, to get the full level of enjoyment out of these events. So they said, you know, it's important to us that we have programming in our town that is accessible, that's inclusive. So, you know, let's make, again, less than $2,500, but let's make this small investment and tell all the members of our community, you know what, these events are for you. Come out, come to these events, get involved, and we'll make sure that you have a good experience and, you know, are able to engage more fully and hear what's going on.
Cool. And sort of almost next door in Newington, their senior and disabled center is partnering with the Parks and Recreation Department to apply their grant for a very interesting kind of concept. You know, it's funny when you watch movies and you see all the folks along the walks in the park and people are jogging by and biking by and walking their dogs. And then there's like these dozens and dozens of people that are all sitting at these these board games that seem to be permanently installed in tables and things. And this sounds like what they're trying to get to in Newington with your grant.
Yeah, yep. So Newington is going to be purchasing some special accessible tables that are inlaid with game boards and putting them in Clem Lemire Park. And the idea behind these is that, you know, we have Newington has some beautiful parks and great outdoor spaces. So how do we create, you know, how does the town create more interest and attractions in these parks? And they're going to have some of the game kits that match these tables available for folks that want to use them. And it's just an invitation for people to come out and use an existing public space in a different way. And again, this is sort of what livable communities are all about. Places have spaces, but how do you really activate those spaces, make them welcoming for people and give them new ways to think about the space and to live, work, and play in those spaces?
Yeah. Cool. Well, that wraps up our review of all of the community grant program projects, but there's two more projects that are going to be coming to Connecticut through AARP from the national entity in July. Just take a quick 30 seconds and remind us what that's all about and how communities could consider applying if it's not too late.
Yeah, so every year our national office has a bigger scale community challenge grant. I think you can get up to $10,000 through this grant program. Our winners from last year that'll be completing the projects this year are Goodwin College in East Hartford, I guess Goodwin University as of this past week.
Yep.
But they're going to be installing a new accessible picnic area along a greenway that they've been working on. They're going to put some programming in, again, take a space that they've been working on, make it more exciting, more usable. And then the town of Wethersfield, my city of residence, they're going to be improving the walkability and bikeability of the town, just making sure that it's a little bit more pedestrian friendly, bike friendly, and helping people get around the town safer. So, you know, as a biker and walker in Wethersfield, I'm thrilled about that.
Well, evidencing how AARP is not just for folks who might qualify for membership, but for every single person in the community, their nationwide Livable Communities Initiative helps communities become great places to live for all residents. They provide resources and publications to encourage local action, like their Roadmap to Livability and the AARP book series, Where We Live, Communities for All Ages. If you'd like to learn more or possibly look at the opportunity to apply for grants in your community, you can just go to aarp.org/livable. Anna Doragasi is their Associate State Director for Advocacy and Outreach here in Connecticut. Anna, great to chat with you, and we'll talk to you again soon. Well, like the leaders before her, we're so pleased to have Dr. Kim Shaughnessy in the studio with us. She has just recently been elevated to the position of president and CEO of Boys and Girls Village. Folks who may not be familiar with the headquarters to the award-winning For the People will be happy to know if they ever cross the Sikorsky Bridge between Stratford and Milford. Going north, they're basically not just going by in close proximity to where we do our broadcasting, but much closer in proximity to what was a long ago Boys Village and is now Boys and Girls Village for quite some time. Founded in 1942 and going strong today with an incredible staff of in excess of 300 employees and sponsoring 15 programs that benefit a close to 800 clients per year from across 50 communities here in Connecticut. We're going to tell you a lot more about it with Dr. Shaughnessy. Kim, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us here in studio. Great to have our neighbor come down and visit, and we're glad to be able to continue to remind people of the critically important work you're doing there. But before we talk about Boys and Girls Village, just give us a quick background on yourself. You've had a lot of roles at Boys and Girls Village and a lot of experience in this line of work, so to speak.
Yes, thank you very much. I have. I started at Boys and Girls Village about 14 years ago, a little over 14 years, and I started as a director back in that time. Before that time, I worked at Bridgeport Hospital in one of their adolescent and child community-based programs. And while that work, doing that direct service work, was a lot of fun, very invigorating, and you need a lot of energy to work with these kids, I felt when I had the opportunity that I could do even more as a director. I thought it could be even making more of a difference, setting policy and developing new programs. And it has been so gratifying to be part of growing the agency. And my role has expanded and grown as well over the years, taking over more responsibilities. I am proud to say that I believe I've enhanced the agency and its services. And in July 2018, I was named president as part of our succession planning and took over as CEO on January 1st of this year.
What I find is great about people like you, because a lot of times in organizations like these, the boards or those who do the recruiting may be attracted to various things. But I think the most successful leaders are the ones that were on the front lines doing the work in the trenches before they took over organizations where they oversaw many others. So you could say, hey, you know, I own the restaurant now, but I washed the dishes, I took out the garbage and such and such. And that's really sort of what you did at Bridgeport Hospital.
Absolutely. We would run groups for the children. And so in running these groups, you'd have to pay close attention to the nuances of what they were not only saying, but what their behaviors were conveying to you. So you always had to be animated and alert, and you had to be thinking constantly on your feet. So a lot of people don't like that kind of work. It's hard to find those of us that do, but it's so gratifying. And yes, I can certainly relate to what my staff is going through and the issues that face them in taking care of these challenging young people.
Well, I remember working in Milford like 30 plus years ago, and I always used to come up from the valley and drive up Wheeler's Farms Road, and there was this like kind of rustic camp looking environment off to one side of the road there, which at that point was Boys Village. Mm-hmm. And you'd go on the parkway and you'd go by the sign and blink and it was gone. Today, a Boys and Girls Village, and particularly under your leadership and under your work in partnership with your many other constituents there and folks, has turned into quite an incredible it's a great asset, really, not just for the community in the region, but for the entire state of Connecticut. Tell us a little bit about the growth of Boys Village, not going back to 1942 necessarily, which is when it all got started, but really what has become not the Boys Village, but the Boys and Girls Village of 2020.
Sure. We have currently over 300 employees and over 15 programs. We've had unprecedented growth in the past 5 to 6 years, where the agency has really doubled in size. So we've had a lot of success in the most recent past. We treat children and families in at-risk situations and assist them in finding healthy developmental pathways. Now, many of our programs are statewide. We have physical locations in Milford, Bridgeport, and Norwalk. We also recently purchased a site in Waterbury in order to make our services more accessible to the northern part of the state. You can cut our programs into four divisions, really, a behavioral health division, special education, permanency planning, and most recently, we've been working with the juvenile justice system. Our school, our therapeutic day school, when I started here 14 years ago, it only went through the eighth grade. It now is a fully, goes all the way from kindergarten to the 12th grade. And additionally, we now are having a life skills and vocational training center is under construction and hopefully will be open in September before the new school year starts.
So in terms of all of the activities there, we want to drill into a couple of them that are pretty new and exciting, starting with this Life Skills and Vocational Training Center. Tell us a little bit about the impetus behind that. I mean, even going back to Boys Village days, it was always about kind of imparting life skills, but mm-hmm. now you've basically kind of taken both the movement and the science and combine that in a facility that really brings it all to provide the best service.
Right. What we found is we have begun to reach out to older youth. And back in the day, it was really younger kids that we were seeing a lot of. But the most underserved population really are these adolescents and older kids who are entering adulthood. Mm-hmm. And while we're treating their psychiatric symptoms or their emotional issues or their past histories of trauma, what we found is that if they still don't have real world life skills, being able to manage their money, financial literacy, job skills, they're still not going to be able to have a productive and successful life. So that's why we thought this vocational training center was perfect to put on our Milford campus and to assist these kids in developing those skills that will help them to be successful.
And even though you're combining kind of the history and the movement and the facility, a program like this doesn't really hit home and make a difference and kind of grab the students' interest unless they're talking or interacting with peers. So with that in mind, you formed a great partnership with one of the local colleges, right?
We have entered into a collaboration with Housatonic and Gateway Community Colleges, which is going to allow our students to both receive credit-worthy instruction at our Life Skills and Vocational Training Center, as well as having the opportunity to receive course credits and to begin to help them seamlessly make the jump to higher education in the rich array of certificate programs offered by these colleges. And we are continuing to look for more and more partners to work with in regards to this.
Well, can you talk a little bit briefly about how the partnership came together? I mean, did you guys go and kind of cast the net toward the college, or did you learn that the college was looking for opportunities?
No, we reached out to them, and we were able to set up tours of their campuses and meetings, and they came to visit our campus. And so we've had talks and discussions with various people. One of the biggest components is the culinary. We already have a big culinary vocational piece on our own campus, but we've also talked with them about perhaps getting some of their instructors to come to our new Life Skills Training Center and teach our kids, as well as we'll be able to give them certificate programs already that we already are able to do, but now they'll actually earn the credit for it. Mm. So some kids will be able to leave school already having credits towards an associate's degree.
Wow,
so we reached out to them very, very much because we knew this was going to be a very optimal partnership.
And as private industries and universities and colleges in Connecticut and educational programs, even high schools and middle schools are partnering to try to make sure they're providing the greatest opportunity for career success for young people. So too is Boys and Girls Village, not just interested in getting more educational partners, but industry partners.
Yes. And actually, this is where I would love to reach out to your listeners.
Sure.
When we would love for them to volunteer. If you run a business, we would like you to come and tell your kids about your professions. It doesn't have to be a months-long commitment. Even a one-off time would be great. Tell the kids about dog grooming. Tell them if you're a florist or if you work at a radio station. we would love you to come volunteer your time and let our kids know about what it takes to go into those different professions because the kids have a lot of varied wide interest. And so while we look to find placements for them as well, it'd be great just to have people come and give informational sessions.
Yeah. Are there other volunteer opportunities? Obviously, folks can maybe consider being a member of a board, but do you have some sort of a foundation or support organization that that's tied that helps with fundraising or targeted capital projects?
For in these kind of things, we do have a whole program for volunteers. So if you want to go to our website, which is www.bgvillage.org, or call us at 203-877-0300, just let us know that you're interested in volunteering or being a part of the organization, and we will connect you to the correct people to move this forward.
Do you also have any opportunity for the public to kind of come to the new this new facility and not just see how awesome it is, but to learn about various ways that they can help, whether it's by writing a check for a donation or getting involved as a mentor or something like that?
We just recently had a groundbreaking event for it, and we got wonderful publicity for it, but also as we continue to construct it, we will have open houses to and invite, you know, our neighbors and the public to come. And again, anybody who wants to partner with us, you know, please just give us a call or check out our website.
Excellent. Also, in terms of folks getting in touch, hit them again with the website.
It's www.bgvillage.org. Or 203-877-0300. And we thank people very much for being so supportive of our agency over these last 70 plus years.
Fantastic. Boys and Girls Village, founded in 1942 as part of the first national First Offenders movement. And since then, it has become Boys and Girls Village and evolved into an agency serving more than 800 clients from across 50 communities, treating children and families at risk in at-risk situations and assisting them in returning to healthy developmental pathways. Find out more, learn how to help, bgvillage.org or call 877-0300. That's 203-877-0300. Our guest this morning in studio is Dr. Kim Shaughnessy. She is CEO and president of Boys and Girls Village. Kim, great to see you. We're going to have you back again soon, and maybe we'll even come over and visit you at Boys and Girls Village. Thanks.
Wonderful. You're welcome anytime.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.